So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
Hello, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget podcast. I'm reviews editor Sherlyn Lowe.
I'm senior editor Devendra Hardawar.
And joining us today is, according to one YouTube comment, the Engadget GOAT, CNR mobile editor, Chris wow. Velasco. Hello.
I contest every inch of that, but hi. Glad to
that
be
was
here.
Actually Chris commenting on his own video through a ghost account. Yeah.
I've got now, several. We're not going to talk about it here. They're for different things.
I mean, so Chris Velasco is joining us because he's in gadgets, not only our GOAT, but our phone guy. And obviously that's because this week, it's been a crazy phone week for some reason. That's what we're here to talk about. the iPhone SE2 just launched out of nowhere, and Chris is going to tell us a bit more about that.
And if phones aren't your thing, we also have an interview with Nathaniel Halpern, the writer and showrunner behind Amazon's Tales from the Loop. This is that series I've mentioned before. It is a science fiction show based on the paintings and artwork of Simon Stålenhag. I think it's really cool, so be sure to check out our chat.
But before we get there, if you're enjoying the podcast, and if you're not, or if you don't think Chris Velasco is the GOAT, just please make sure to subscribe to the Engadget podcast on your podcatcher of choice. Leave us an iTunes rating so that we know what you feel. And for your deeper thoughts, please send us an email to podcast@engadget.com.
Yeah, and actually the best place to leave us notes is just, in our iTunes reviews. Tell us what you think of Chris and Trillian and
really,
me, I guess, in there.
We're really reading those.
This is bad. This is going really bad. Like, this is going to sink the podcast now, guys.
We're going to have all of you, your fans coming and leaving us 5-star reviews. Mm-hmm. I'm really hoping for that, Chris. So this week alone, like, at least 2 major phones were announced. And in the previous few weeks, there's been a slew of phone news. And I think that it feels to me like MWC got canceled, but here are all the phones anyway. I don't know, V, what do you think?
Well, look, like, these companies couldn't sit on these devices forever. It was a question of, do we just sort of slip them out in a press release and put them on sale a couple days later, or do we try and have these approximations of the events that would normally pepper the year anyway? And we've seen a pretty interesting mix of the two so far.
What is the mix like? Like, who's doing what?
So iPhone, which is probably the biggest cheap, well, mm-hmm.
the biggest, the smallest probably, phone announcement.
The biggest deal.
The biggest deal for sure. So Apple, around this time of year, I mean, they've typically done spring events around March, April. Like, this is a thing that pops up on their calendar very regularly. We all kind of expected we'd be going on a trip to, it was Chicago one year. Like, they're kind of all over the place with this stuff. But obviously that's impossible now. So we got sort of a press release in the morning, and you'll maybe get some photos after that, and then it'll go on sale sometime next week, which is pretty standard for them. But on the other hand, we have companies like OnePlus, which have historically done big events as well to commemorate the launches of their biggest new smartphones. And instead of having a live stage show with a packed audience, it's just one guy on a stream sort of walking around a space and explaining what's going on with the phone. They try their best to capture the feel of one of these events without having a real physical component at all.
Is this the first time Apple has launched a phone without an actual keynote?
In the last few years, I think, perhaps, that might be true.
Yeah, although they've done that for some iPad models. Like, we just saw the last slew of iPads came just via press release, right? The iPad
Pros. When you get sort of upgrades to, especially the lowest end iPad, which is itself an important device, but maybe not the most exciting all of the time. Yeah, that's very much a, here's what it is, you can buy it in a week, have fun kind of thing. And yeah, you're right, this is the first time we've seen Apple adopt this to the iPhone, which is pretty wild.
Have to say, this is what we've been asking for. Like, when we've talked about the, I think the overblown nature of a lot of these tech events. It turns out it took a global pandemic for them to be like, you know, we could just do this stuff over live stream. And I prefer it. It feels like less of a waste of, first of all, carbon emissions for people to travel all over the place just to see a phone. But also a lot more efficient too. Like if they could just get us the hardware, then we write up our own stuff. We don't have to deal with their hype, right?
I think that V and I will have things to disagree with you on about that, just because we both enjoy the show life. I think a little bit, just the
y'all are kids. Work, okay.
The work of it is not as fun, but the getting to hang out and see people in person and see the executives at Apple in person or at whatever company in person, those are, I think, fun. I don't know.
Yeah. No, FaceTime is really important. I think this is a very personal thing, but I feel like I'm at my best when I'm like running around and like freaking out and stressing out over writing a story that's as fast and as smart and as good as possible. I personally feel that like event coverage is the thing that makes me – it pushes me to do better when I normally – when that's very difficult. So I do kind of miss having that extra like stressful energy in my life.
See, that's because you guys are all workaholics. I just want to point this out. Like you want to be stressed. But anyway, what do we got this week?
Yeah, V. So what's the new iPhone about? What, the new iPhone SE anyway?
iPhone SE. It's last year's really good iPhone in the body of a like 3-year-old iPhone. It's cool, guys. It's going to be awesome. I'm being a bit glib, but I do think this is a really important device. It's functionally the exact same body as the iPhone 8. So we're looking at a 4.7-inch Retina display. We're looking at a home button with a Touch ID sensor, which is now surprisingly useful because Face ID can't understand what our faces look like with masks on.
Yep.
We've got 64 gigs of storage at the base level. And the wildest part is that it's going to cost $399. So that's $50 less than the iPhone 8 that was totally comparable in storage capacity and everything else that Apple basically just discontinued yesterday.
I saw that they discontinued it because I was like trying to look for the physical dimensions to compare and I just couldn't find it on Apple's website anymore. Here's the thing. Welcome to my weekly WhatsApp corner. Anyway, my friend texted me to ask about the iPhone SE 2. And I was like,
SE 2, right? It's just iPhone
SE. SE.
Okay, the SE, the 2020
the second
edition.
SE,
yeah, the second SE. She wanted to know if she should upgrade from her 8 or 8 Plus, like one of those. And I said that, you know, the chip is going to be much better because it's using the A13 Bionic, right?
Correct.
But I'm not sure if the camera is an upgrade, and I'm not also sure. She just asked me. She was like, will I, if I get this, because it's a good deal, because she thinks it's $400 is a really good price. But she was like, is it technically a downgrade from her iPhone 8 or 8 Plus?
No, well, so it kind of depends. If she has an iPhone 8, there is no way that this is a downgrade. At worst, it's a lateral move because you get the same sort of dated design, which I think is probably one of the things people are not taking into consideration. Like, I've had people ask me if the SE is going to be Apple's next big iPhone, and I think it's fair to say that phones largely don't look like that anymore. So the appeal is perhaps not as strong as it could be, but in terms of power, yes, Shilin, to your point, the A13 Bionic is an awesome chipset. It's the fastest and most performant we've ever seen Apple squeeze into a smartphone, which is true every year, but, you know, that's fine. The camera should be an improvement. So we've had a bit of back and forth with Apple about this. They finally confirmed to Richard Lai out of Engadget Chinese last night that it does not use the same sensor as the iPhone 11. On paper, they have a lot of similarities. They're both 12-megapixel sensors. They have f1.8 apertures. They have six-element lenses, 28-millimeter equivalent like lens distance. So performance should be similar, but it's not going to be as good. My personal hunch is it's closer to what we'd see out of the iPhone XS, just because that's a cheaper component they probably still have access to. But until we test these things, there's no way to know for sure.
But it's a single camera on the back. And what Apple introduced, dual camera with the XS, I want to say. Which one was it?
I think it was the iPhone 10.
The
first dual camera. But and playing in the mid-range space, which Apple is now clearly gearing up to do in a big way, like, phones in that space are not super expensive, but they have huge screens. They have multiple cameras. It's tough to get a feel for what Apple – I feel like Apple's going to do pretty well here regardless, but the competition is definitely not nothing.
to your friend's question, Trillin, like, this doesn't seem like an upgrade, honestly. Like, if you're going to upgrade over that phone, like, you want maybe an edge-to-edge screen. Like, maybe you want to look more closely at the 10R or wait until this year's, you know, phones at the end of the year. Because my parents have iPhone 8s, and I would not tell them to upgrade because they will not really notice the processor difference or even the camera upgrades, right?
I mean, I'm going to let V say because he's the expert here, but I told her that the main thing you're going to notice a difference in is if your phone's already that old, you might notice like a faster overall, because it's a new phone, you're going to get that new phone feel. Mm-hmm. You're also maybe going to get longer battery life, but correct me if I'm wrong, V, is that true?
So Apple is not really specified. The official quote is, you get the same great battery life that you got out of the iPhone 8, which I don't remember being particularly awesome the first time around.
It's just a new battery, yeah.
It's great battery, about it. And like one could argue that the A13 is a little more efficient in some ways, so it's maybe not taking as much of a toll, but I can't imagine the difference is huge. But yeah, to your point about performance, like, unless you're routinely pushing your smartphone to your limits, unless you're a big gamer, unless you're like a big augmented reality person, you'll notice some like day-to-day improvements between the A9 and the A13 in the iPhone SE. But wait until September. Hopefully Apple does this whole crazy rigmarole again and we'll get some new iPhones that are probably more worthy of an upgrade.
There's very few small phones, like sub 5-inch phones left. And for the iPhone SE second generation to have a 4.7-inch screen, I think that there's still a market for that. I think a lot of people still want that size of a phone. Not because y'all have small hands, but because it just fits in pockets better,
but
I guess.
But really, I want to point out, like, this one still has bezels. This still looks like the iPhone 8.
Yeah.
So it has the top and bottom bezels. It has stuff around the sides. And the reason I really like the iPhone 10 is that we finally got more of an edge-to-edge screen. And that actually made it more compact. So you got a bigger screen in a smaller case. It would have been nice to see Apple kind of go that route a little. But I guess I got to maybe wait until next year, when they can call, like, the iPhone 10 design that the 11 still has right now, they can call that, classic, right? They could call that old hat. So, yeah.
I don't know. What do you think, V? Like, is Apple ever going to do an SE that has an edge-to-edge design?
I mean, it's inevitable. I think
it
kind of depends on how well this one does. I think based on the strength of its performance and just how popular smaller phones do seem to be in certain really crucial markets to Apple, this one's going to do pretty well, and it's going to keep the SE line going because, for people who don't know, Apple made the first iPhone SE in 2016, discontinued it after about a year. It continued to be sold. They had a bunch of stock, and it used to go for really cheap if you could find the right deal. But they stopped like actively producing them after a while. So they effectively took a break from building purpose-built sort of mid-range phones. Now that they're entering the space again, I don't see them necessarily waiting 3 years again to try. Mm-hmm.
So there were the 10Rs and the like Cs and the 5Cs. Apple has done like the so-called light or cheap phones for a bit, but the SE feels like a different beast altogether. I mean, okay, so Apple is to me a company that does very expensive phones in general. There's always been an Apple premium on iPhones, but then now attempting to make a really good budget mid-rangey phone, right? Another company announced a new phone this week that takes the opposite direction and I'm trying to talk about OnePlus here very inelegantly, but the OnePlus 8 and 8 Pro launched this week. And OnePlus, I don't know, I think V knows this much better than I do, but when they first burst onto the scene, they were trying to be so-called flagship killers with like really good high-end specs on a phone, but for like about half the price. It was like, what, $300-ish, $350?
Yeah, I think $350 was where the OnePlus One landed originally.
Imagine that. Like, they were taking on the Samsungs and the then LGs of the world, but with like a $350 phone that was just really good. But this week, the 8 and 8 Pro, I know, V, you reviewed the OnePlus 8 Pro, and your main takeaway is that what? Like, price is no longer the main reason to get these guys?
I mean, if you're looking at a smartphone right now and you don't want to spend as much money, you will get a bit of a savings with the OnePlus. That said, the 8 Pro is not nearly as inexpensive as other Pro devices in its past. Bear in mind, so the standard OnePlus 8 Pro, 8 gigs of RAM, 128 gigs of storage, that's the one I've actually been testing, so the lower spec model, that's $900. Last year's OnePlus 7 Pro, that same configuration was $750. So we're looking at a considerable increase in the price right off the bat. I think that's largely because of the screen, which is great. But there's also, I mean, I don't think OnePlus could justify every decision here. And I know there's a lot of people in the community right now who are upset that OnePlus kind of sold out and embraced the flagship performance and the flagship price.
I mean, I didn't see it that way. Like, I saw it as the 8 starts at, what, $699, which is still $700. But, I mean, and then you compare that against the likes of, say, a Galaxy S20 or the base model iPhone. I'm not going to compare it with a Pixel 4 because I think that starts a little, like, around the same price. But, like, and Galaxy S20 starts at, what, $999 as well, right? And so you're still saving, like, what, $200 if you buy the base models of both?
It's, yeah, I think there's an important distinction to be made between these two phones. Like, you would know better than me. I think you've spent more time with the regular OnePlus 8 than I have. That also has the Snapdragon 865, so like full high-end performance. Everything else is just dialed down from the 8 Pro in a way that doesn't always feel satisfying. So 90 hertz screen instead of 120, differences in...
It's not like
IP water resistance rated, which might just be a technicality. But it for me, it doesn't seem like a big enough deal compared to something like the 7 Pro or the 7T Pro, where I would say, hey, if you have one of those, yeah, iPhone 8, or God, I keep saying
they the need better names.
They really do. I'm getting really tired of just saying the word OnePlus. But the
do
OnePlus
they have,
8.
Do they have any more affordable models left? Because I don't... These are cheaper than the current flagships, but I wouldn't call these affordable.
Yeah.
Is the thing.
Yeah.
So they used to do... This was quite a few years ago now. They used to do the OnePlus X, which was their first like mid-range phone attempt. And as I recall, it maybe didn't totally bomb, but it didn't do very
good. It didn't
good
do very
at
well
all.
At all. Yeah. The OnePlus X series got discontinued like what, a year after it was debuted.
Yeah, something like that. It was a really quick turnaround. It was a disappointment to everyone involved.
I liked it because, again, like the SE, it was like a little bit of a smaller phone, and that the fact that it was cheaper gave me a lot more reason to try to find excuses for it. But at the end of the day, that's what I was doing, is to make excuses for a phone, and that's not really a good thing.
One thing I would like to see, by the way, especially now that we're seeing a new iPhone SE and a bunch of things, like, I wish there were easier ways to just, like, hop between devices that was easier than just, like, swapping SIM cards, you know? Like, we have eSIM. It's not standard yet, but it's going to become like the thing. I wish I could just like, okay, I want to run. Yeah, I want to go for a run with my iPhone SE because that's tiny, and just move all my calls and everything to that super easily. Move my service to that. You can have multiple devices.
Turn one phone active and one.
Yeah, have it like switch what's your active device. That would be kind of awesome.
I wonder if that's just a bougie perspective.
No, definitely. Everything we're talking about here is super bougie stuff, guys. Like, let's be real. We're talking about $800 phones is like semi-affordable at this point.
I know.
I'm just saying.
But that's
for the tech geeks out there. Like, I'm sure a lot of our listeners too have multiple phones or backup.
Right, like
phones,
your work phone versus your personal.
Yeah, maybe
phone.
You bought the iPhone 11 Pro and you want a tiny thing too. Like, it is. I think that flexibility would be a lot. It would be a nice thing to have down the line.
Hey, Dev, what did you think of? Kind of off topic, but what did you think about the Palm phone? Do you remember that
thing?
Oh, good
Lord.
Love those guys. I love the look of it.
No, the tiny one. Do you remember the tiny one?
I love the idea of the Palm phones, right? The idea of like a secondary thing. I just want...
Yes.
I miss the Palm Pre. I really like the Palm Pre design.
Wait, did you really?
Yeah. It was so good.
That was the only phone in my life I've ever sat in a line to buy.
It's so cute. It's so cute. Yeah. I would love a secondary phone like that.
WebOS forever.
Okay.
What's up?
I guess there's a market for the secondary phone, like the Palm phone that TCL made and like released last year, I think.
Those all suck because they have these weird compromises and like, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is kind of bad.
I want on-the-fly device switching. Switch it, like switch your service to your laptop when you want to go work somewhere.
That'd be cool. Dev, do you have any eSIM devices?
I mean, I have the 11 Pro, which is eSIM, I believe.
Yes, but like not... It's not as easy to work with as, say, like Project Fi
or something. By the way, kids and listeners and whoever, when you are activating your iPhones, maybe try to get that eSIM action. Because then when you travel, when we can actually leave the confines of our homes and countries again, then you'll want to throw in a SIM. Which is that would have been my plan all the time, right? But
I will say, like, I will forever preach the good word of eSIM, and not just because
you've written about it quite a bit.
I've written about it quite a bit. Commenters will point out that, yeah, you work for Verizon, of course you're going to worship eSIM. I'm like, dude, No.
It makes just, all our lives easier if we have
like standard disclaimer. Yes, my parent company is Verizon Wireless, but I don't love everything that they do all the time. But eSIM is just a technology that I think is going to be very convenient for us when it works right and when the carriers all support it. Yeah. Right. Anyhow,
quick shout out though, iPhone SE 2020 does have dual SIM via eSIM, which the iPhone didn't have. So if you're
there you go. That's something. And I don't think we talk about it enough. Like, I think eSIM and the idea of iPhones being dual SIM, that's something geeks know. But even, I'm sure, like, every listener of the show has not understood, like, how to really take advantage of that. And also, when you're traveling, it's really hard to, like, get the eSIM part activated in another language or something. You want, at that point, you want to just throw in a SIM card. Anyway.
It's true.
What is the great carrier that you can find the OnePlus phones at, guys?
For once, the OnePlus phone is coming to Verizon. Hey, again, our parent company.
We need like a theme song. We need like a jingle or something. I don't know.
Anyway, so the OnePlus 8 and 8 Pro, I think, are still significant phones. I think there's a growing market for them, even though they're no longer the like affordable options.
Yeah, I mean, like, to be clear, these are still phenomenal phones. Like, I haven't been hugely thrilled by the Galaxy S20 series. Shirlin was gracious enough to handle the review while I went on the last vacation before the world ended. So
you were gone for 3 weeks. I died.
It was like two and change. And you got last year off from MWC. So
I did not take 3 weeks. But anyway, yes. No, I'm happy to help you, bro.
Yes. But so the OnePlus 8 Pro is the first flagship of the year that I've really spent time with. I've used the Galaxy S20 Ultra and I like it quite a bit, but the Pro is maybe my favorite phone of the year so far. Like the Oxygen OS based on Android 10 is just super clean. It's super thought out. The big knock against OnePlus in the past is that its cameras historically haven't been great, and they're not amazing now. The telephoto camera that they say is, you know, lossless 3x zoom is not optical, so In no way is actually lossless.
But it's lossless. But they say lossless. There's just a tiny asterisk next to it. Yeah.
The big selling point of this thing is the screen. I don't know, Shirlin, you've seen it. Dev, you should.
Yeah.
I should like come by and leave it on your doorstep so you can check it out. This thing is wild. It does 120 hertz at quad HD. It's like every HDR certification you can get. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like they're coming for Samsung with these features, right? The 120 hertz screen, but better than the S20 Ultra because the S20 Ultra could only do it at full HD.
Yeah.
And even on my, I mean, I spent more time with the OnePlus 8 base version, like you said, and even the 90 hertz screen on that thing, it just looks so nice. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh crap, this thing feels like it's floating on top of some water and it's just gliding away from me. And
90 hertz seems like the bare minimum that we'll want for screens. Like, this is something we've talked about. Until you see it in action, I feel like it's hard to convey, but gamers who play on like maybe higher refresh rate monitors will know. Like, it's so smooth. It's beautiful.
So it's just funny to me that a company like OnePlus that's been indie for a while is really what's going to maybe give Samsung a run, well, not a real run for its money, but something to look to as competition. Meanwhile, Samsung's old rivals like LG are seriously struggling, in my opinion, really, really, really scraping the bottom of the barrel here. We got this week. Let's just give y'all the news bit this week, right? Because LG has been working on a flagship. They want you to know they're still around. And this week, the company sent out a press release saying that, hey, the name of our new flagship that we've been talking about is going to be called Velvet. It's Velvet. It's Velvet. I wanted to die. I had to write about this for another article. And the whole reason LG is doing this is that I think it's fully aware its names suck. Okay, previous LG flagship names have been this. LG V60 ThinQ 5G. That review that V just wrote.
Yeah.
Then the LG G8X ThinQ dual screen. Dual screen's part of the goddamn thing's name. So I had to keep writing it in a hands-on recently. And I was like, what the heck?
And they really, first of all, banked on ThinQ as like their thing. Because it's on their TVs. It's on their smart devices. And every time I talk to an LG executive and I'm like, what? Yes. What are you guys doing? Like, first of all, we don't know how to pronounce it. This is not exciting or interesting. Nobody knows what it really means. But anyway, we got Velvet.
It means nothing.
Because Velvet is something we attach to fast and powerful devices. apparently.
What do you think of the name Velvet?
Bear in mind, we're talking about the company that has previously released phones called the LG Chocolate and the LG Renoir. And I think at one point the LG Beauty, like beauty,
beauty.
But the view.
With a V.
So suffice it to say, the masterminds in the marketing department at LG in Korea should be fired.
I don't know. I think they should be promoted.
No, I feel like...
I mean, I guess we're still talking about them.
I could just imagine the CEO of LG or whoever is just like in his James Bond lair with his tiny dog or cat. And just like, he just walks around and just says, thank you. Yes. Make it so.
It makes 5 years of LG's feel good. Yeah. Okay. So in the press release, I think LG, I don't know if they are aware how silly this all sounds, but they were like, oh, the word velvet is meant to evoke images of lustrous smoothness and premium softness. And I was like, what the crap? It's like you're writing gadget porn in the press release.
If they made a phone made out of cloth, then yeah, I'm down. Like, then you call it velvet. Sure.
Yeah, but it's not. And the whole thing is that this phone, again, according to the press release, features a so-called unique raindrop camera. And if you've looked at the renders we've seen from the company earlier, it looks like they have a rear camera system that features like 3 or 4 circles that are consecutively smaller than each other. Mm-hmm. So it's like a big primary camera and then a slightly smaller circle below it. And then it's like, so I guess that's raindrop. I'm not sure it could be.
Is that it? Wait, I didn't catch that. Is that it?
That's all it is. But
or it could be the front camera.
So instead of putting camera sensors in a square, they put them in a line. Awesome. Thanks, guys.
I will say I do appreciate companies thinking more about these ugly camera sensors because I don't like the squares. I think the squares and everything are big, ugly aesthetic humps. It's something that's different, but yeah, this render barely looks like a render. It looks like a pencil drawing of like what LG wants a phone to be. Anyway, I think
they drew it on velvet. I think they drew it straight on velvet.
It's a velvet painting, which would be nice, actually. There's your marketing pitch. Like, velvet paint all your renders, please.
So I think the question then is like, is this enough to help LG remain relevant? Like a rebranding and a new design language, is that? Because LG has honestly, in my opinion, been struggling. I don't know about you, V. You might be fonder of them than I am, but.
No, I love everyone we work with at LG. No shade on them. They're doing their best.
Same.
LG as a company, at least as far as phones go, they're tanking. They're terrible. Like,
oh God.
The V60 ThinQ, which I just reviewed, is passable in certain ways. I'm willing to make concessions for it. I think my headline was something like, this is a compromised phone, but I liked it anyway. Because it was cheap and you got, like, it was, all of its value was predicated on how much you got for the money. So you got, like, a decent screen, an 865 chipset, a huge battery, which was arguably the best thing about it. And then this, like, case that you could attach to the phone to get a second screen that I found better than the last time, but still more or less completely nonsensical.
Right.
Like, I'm getting frustrated in my brain right now because to this date, I do not understand what this company's priorities are. It's like they don't care anymore. And sometimes that's a recipe for a company to do really interesting stuff. And maybe this dual screen counts to some people. But just are you trying to do a good job anymore? Let me know where your head's at, guys.
It's a shame because what's really driving LG, I think, is like their display innovation.
Absolutely.
Like, right? Like LG Display... Yeah. Has been making the best OLEDs. They make the OLEDs that Samsung and other companies like Sony puts into their TVs. Like, that's how this works. LG has a lot of like hardware innovation, but yeah, man, their product stuff, I don't know.
I have a proposal for LG. I think if you're coming up with names like Velvet and LG Chocolate, just go and open a Korean bakery. Just do that, and I'll be so much happier. I'll be like, yeah, I'll buy the Velvet cupcake. I'll buy the chocolate muffin. Yeah.
So this is where you'll go on your weekly pilgrimage once we're allowed to leave our homes again.
Oh my gosh, yes. Yeah. I can't wait to eat anyway.
What are those? I was at a Korean cafe when I was doing the Oculus conference, and it's the little pineapple pastries or something, pineapple and walnut. Those are really good. Little walnut cakes. But anyway, call it walnut. Give me the LG walnut
and
make it delicious.
Make it delicious.
Make it a phone I can eat, please. I'm hungry.
So, okay, we've got... We've got the iPhone SE, we've got OnePlus 8 and 8 Pro, we've got the LG Velvet sort of being teased. We also heard from another scrappy company trying to do its best here, Motorola, this week announced that it'll be hosting a virtual launch event on April 22nd for an upcoming flagship. Now, we don't know officially what this flagship is going to be yet, but rumors are pretty clear that it will be something called the Edge Plus. V, what are your thoughts?
I've been having conversations with Motorola. I was a very big Motorola fan for a long, long time. And not too long after the Lenovo acquisition, I kind of, like, they just shifted priorities and, like, they didn't seem to focus on the things I cared about. So my relationship with them kind of faded a bit. But I've been talking to them for years and asking, you know, when are you going to do this again? The last flagship that we got, the last proper, like, expensive flagship phone we got was, I think, 2016 was the year with the Moto X? Z.
Yeah.
Oh, the Z. Yeah.
Where they went crazy with the modular stuff. And, like, God bless them. We talk about companies that maybe don't do interesting stuff every time. And that was a phenomenally fascinating phone. And it just never went anywhere. Like,
they have a history of this, by the way. Like, even before the Lenovo thing, when they were under Google, the whole Moto X thing, I thought was
I like the Moto mods,
Yeah, I loved being able to, like, customize my Moto X before they sent it to me and get that wood back or something.
Yes.
But, like, yeah, like, their that whole experiment with the mods kind of went south, and they continued to support it for years after most people expected them to. So now that they've, like, now that 5G is a thing and they no longer have a reason to support the 5G mod as strongly as it used to, I think they're now able to just put that saga behind them and move on into this premium device, which I think is rumored to be called the Edge Plus.
Yeah, yeah. The rumor is that this is the Edge Plus. The rumor is that this will have, like, high-end specs that we haven't seen out of Motorola in a while. You know, based on the leaks, it's likely a 6.7-inch screen. The reason it's called the Edge Plus is because, hey, remember the Galaxy Edge? Yeah, this thing has
and the
same
Galaxy Edge Plus. Why? I hope that's not the real name, because literally that's Samsung's name.
I hope not either. Sure. They're recycling names now. But basically, it's got, like, what, two curved edges, and I don't know what they're going to do with that. It's just nice to look at, maybe.
Nothing, really. Like, it's just there for looks. Like, the OnePlus has this to an extent, too. They're only there to look cool and drive people like me effing crazy. Because my hand meat always brushes against the side of the phone, and I'm touching stuff.
Wait, excuse me,
you're
what?
My hand meat.
Oh, say that again.
Hand
but slower.
Hand meat.
Okay.
My fingers are short, but my palm is huge, so I have a preponderance of hand meat.
Now I'm just thinking of hamburgers with V's hands as the patties.
Yeah, just Vienna Anyhow. Sausages over here. Yeah.
Gross. Y'all are gross. but I agree with you. I've had issues with the, like, double edged screens where, like, even I don't have a meaty hand like yours, but I still, like, struggle with accidentally activating things or accidentally, like, triggering edge apps on the Galaxy Edge phone. So, like, I really, really don't like that. But I guess that looks nice.
How sad is it that we're not even talking about the Razer at this point? Ooh. So much work, so much effort into that.
Wait, the Razer, the God flip,
and then there's the Z Flip 2, and oh man.
Oh boy, the Razer, the poor Moto Razer. But the Moto Edge Plus, if the rumors are true, will also feature a what looks like a triple camera system with a 108 megapixel primary sensor, some telephoto and wide angle lens options. Seems to be pretty, like, the default setting for most flagship phones these days. Right, V, I think.
Yeah, like, if someone had to meme this, like, the caption would say, this is a flagship, period, and it would be the dog standing in the room of fire. Like, it's it does everything that you would want an expensive phone to do, but nothing else. And I think a company, well, a brand like Motorola under Lenovo, not having done this for so long, really needed something to get people worked up about the brand again, especially after the Razer kind of flopped, right? Like,
so sad.
That was a $400 phone and a $1,500 phone body. You need
with
that,
a, with
you
a
do
screen
need to recover
that
from
awful.
That at least a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so sad because they had the nostalgia value in the bank and they couldn't cash out all of that.
Timing.
At all.
If that phone had come out, like, last year, you know, earlier last year, like, it would have been revolutionary, but no. Well,
which it was supposed to, by the way. It was supposed to launch in June, and then things happened.
I guess we'll have to wait till April 22nd to see what this rumored flagship from Motorola will be. But also, Moto, also, like, we saw this week reviews of the Moto G Power, I want to say.
The G Power and the G Stylus.
Okay, so two phones that we've heard of before. Last year, I think you got hands-on with these guys, right?
Look, time does not exist for me anymore. I can't tell you when I did what.
He exists in a vacuum. Whenever, at some point in the universe, you checked out these phones. What's the main highlight for the G Power and the G Stylus?
So, as the names sort of indicate, the G Power, it's the specs escape me, but it's obviously a device that's focused on giving you excellent battery life. So it has a huge battery, you know, mid-range processor, screen that isn't much to write home about. Like, it's a perfectly adequate phone, very much in the vein of Motorola's long line of perfectly adequate phones. The Moto G Stylus is weird because it basically takes the G Power formula and makes it a little better. But the standout feature is, of course, the stylus, which in no way, like, it's just a stick. Like, it's in no way active. It's not special. It's literally
Wait, it's not
just
even plastic active?
Stick. Yeah.
It's a metal stick. Credit to them. It's a metal stick with a plastic nub.
That's not right.
It is intensely unpleasant to write with because it's so small. And as I've said, I have a preponderance of hand meat. These are devices that fall so firmly into Motorola's like typical formula with some weird twist just for fun, I guess. I don't know what to do with this company anymore. Like,
The G's used to be the like low end phones that we'd recommend to people because I think those and the Moto E, like those were the cheap good phones for
they're
a while.
They're the mid range E.
And they still are. Like, they're still great phones for the price. If you don't mind not having frills, which I think is a lot of people looking to buy a $200 phone, you're going to do totally fine. But like Motorola they've shifted a lot of their like more ambitious lines of thinking into their Motorola One line, many of which are just not sold here. Mm-hmm. So they're doing fine in aggregate, but at least when you're looking at them from a very US perspective, like their strategy doesn't seem to be particularly interesting or valuable.
I think that Moto has changed hands so many times. They were owned by Google and now they're owned by Lenovo, that their identity is a little up in the air. Mm-hmm. I think that though with Lenovo as parents, I think that's why we're seeing all these quirky things happen, right? Because Lenovo itself is not one to shy away from trying out these very quirky experiments, like the dual screen yoga tablet, like really like a laptop with an e-ink screen for a lid or a speaker built into the hinge of your laptop. Lenovo is maybe what's giving Moto these like ideas here. I don't know. But
I love that Lenovo
is
still throwing out all these crazy ideas.
Yeah.
I wish the build quality on their devices.
Yeah.
Like we've talked about this before. Their ThinkPads have gone way downhill, like quality wise. So
it's very
sad.
I don't
know.
Yeah. It's very sad that the ThinkPads in general are getting so many complaints all over the place now. I'm seeing them on the internet all the time. ThinkPads were such a great line. They're still good lines, but I just think Moto also needs to work on that. I think Moto, I really want someone, basically, whether it's Moto or LG, to give the Samsungs and the Apples some real competition. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
I feel like all these companies are doing it in their own ways, but nobody has like the great product vision, you know, like that's the thing. Even Samsung, we made fun of them for years and they still have way too many phones. But I don't know. Are there other phones we have to talk about, guys?
Speaking of Samsung making way too many phones, I mean, this Samsung this week also last week dropped like a half a dozen Galaxy A series phones. So, you know, like their total number of phones they make now is 213.
We never count the Galaxy A though, because they always have like, I feel like 10 different A models or something. And
I always felt a little bad about that, honestly, because the A series largely is made up of like really solid mid-range phones, and people care about those. Like those are phenomenal phones. If you don't care about phones, or if you have a parent who like needs something that won't crap out on them, a Samsung A series would be great. And you know, it's I think it largely falls to me that like I haven't paid as much attention to them, but
It's just that, I mean, we all have different priorities and we have to review so many things that like the A series doesn't stand out enough, I think, to warrant a review on our end yet. But we might one day get to it. Speaking of things we generally don't review, there's a lot of phones in China. There's a lot of good phones coming out of China and we don't get around to them because you're never going to be able to buy them here in the US, but they're still doing really interesting things. Oppo this week announced the Reno Ace 2. And the standout feature of it is that it supports the fastest wireless charging ever in a phone. for now, which is yay. I know, awesome. I know Dev has thoughts on wireless charging per se, but I just want to give you like the quick down low here. I'm Sherlyn down low, by the way.
Did you hear my eyes roll just then?
I heard your eyes roll, yes. The Reno A2 supports wireless charging at 40 watts. So it will get the phone's 4,000 milliamp hour battery up to 100% in 56 minutes, which if you do the math, it might come out, you know, like assuming all things stay equal, to about 50% charge in about 30 minutes, which is almost like a wired charging experience. And for anyone, like I'm saying, anyone who's ever tried wirelessly charging anything, you'll know that that's really freaking fast.
Yeah.
Like, it's really fast for wireless. And I mean, I think that's impressive. I do think that there's questions as to why wireless charging needs to exist. I think that Dev has a whole spiel on that.
Well, it's like I'm of two minds. Like, I think if you had like broad wireless charging availability of like when you just throw your phone on your desk and it like got a little bit of trickle charge, I think that's cool. But yeah, in every way, wireless charging is worse than wired because it's slower. It's nice to see this one may get a little faster, but it's slower. You can't do anything with your phone. I think we're all used to just like cradling our phones with a charging cable, you know, while we're in bed or something. Like, you can still use your phone while you're cable charging. That's much faster. It's more secure. Can't count the amount of times I've tried to wirelessly charge something overnight and you just like miss the charger, or like a cat moves it or something overnight and you lose that charge. It's just unreliable. And I'm also worried about like what is going on, like getting really high power moving wirelessly, you know, between two devices. Like, what are the potential fire hazards there? Whenever any of these companies push power, like Samsung did with the Note 7, things go bad, you know?
Yeah, I'm with you. I think that I'm not sure I entirely trust Oppo to be the ones to do this really well. But at least it's doing something different and new. I mean, they Chinese phones were the first ones to start the notched camera thing. The whole all screen look was like, I think one of the very first was a Nubia. V, you're the smartphone historian, so I'm gonna like rely on you on the facts here, but I do think that a lot of these features we see emerging out of like that side of the world are going to make their way here, and I think, you know, probably for the better in general.
Yeah, I mean, we've already seen that start, and I think the OnePlus is a great example. OnePlus is I forget exactly what the corporate structure is, but like there's this company BKK, which I believe owns OnePlus and Oppo, which explains why the OnePlus 8 Pro is basically the Oppo Find X2 with just like a couple extra things thrown into it. But it does also have like that super fast wireless charging. It's not as fast as the Reno Ace 2 X5, whatever it's called. It's like it's a 30 watt wireless charging setup. But like to your point, Dev, like I've been testing it. I plop the phone in the cradle overnight. Mm-hmm. And it just gets so warm in the short term that I'm like,
safe.
There's potential here for something to be bad, right?
Just be careful. Crazy for like keep a fire extinguisher near your devices while you're testing these things.
I don't know that I have a fire extinguisher.
What the hell? Get a fire extinguisher. What is you too, Sherlyn? You who's complaining about people setting fire to your alarm? Yeah. Everybody, get fire extinguishers. This is old tech. What are you doing? All right, let's move on to what we're working on. I'm testing out some fun new hardware this week, Intel's Nook 9 Extreme. And I took a first look at this at CES. This is their biggest Nook ever. It is a tiny little portable desktop, but it's big enough to fit like one of those like half-sized desktop GPUs, which I think is the main selling point. So this is a little DIY kit. You buy it with like a compute... they have like this interchangeable compute thing going on, like different cards you can slide in, but you buy it with compute. You have to add your own video card, memory, storage, OS, all that fun stuff. But at the end of the day, what you get is a very nice small system that is as powerful as a full-size desktop. And it's pretty cool. I'm writing it up right now. It's very fast. What they've managed to do just in terms of cooling and fitting enough hardware into something this small, I think is really cool, but man, is it expensive. Like the build I'm testing, which is will probably cost between $1,000 to $1,500 in a desktop, this whole kit would be close to $3,000.
What? Why is it so much more expensive?
Because the kit itself is so expensive. Like the little compute cards are doing The idea is that you could maybe eventually swap out the CPU card in this, you know, down the line. But so even then, it's going to be more expensive than usual. Yeah, this is a cool kit for people who love the tiny desktop life. I think there are a lot of people, and especially PC enthusiasts out there, who maybe have a lot of extra money and want like a really nice, cute, powerful PC. It's sort of like the hot rod thing, except really small form factor. So anyway, it's really cool. I really dig it. I just don't know who will actually buy this thing. So look up for my coverage soon. I'm also testing out Minecraft with ray tracing. That's something we've been seeing NVIDIA and Microsoft teasing over the past year. The beta is hitting basically as we're recording this right now. It's hitting Windows. If you have an RTX NVIDIA graphics card and Minecraft, you could just flip it on. It's really cool. It adds very realistic lighting. And it's amazing to see how a simple looking game like a Minecraft, which is, you know, just blocks and flat textures, it really comes alive once you start playing with the lighting, like the actual sunlight and actual reflections on surfaces. I think it's a really cool view of like what ray tracing will bring to the future of games. It's just kind of revolutionary. But yeah, it's also something only people with the super powerful NVIDIA graphics cards can use for right now. Yeah, it's a good preview. I'm really digging
it. One day these powerful cards will come to a Switch and we'll see Animal Crossing with ray tracing.
Yeah, maybe not a Switch, but we're definitely going to see it on the next gen consoles first. Like, we know the PlayStation 5 and the Xbox
One day,
Series X will all have it. And then you'll get it for your Switch, yes, and you'll be so happy, Sherlyn.
I'll be so happy. Meanwhile, I am back to full reviewing life, and like Dev, I am also reviewing a piece of hardware. I can't talk about it just yet, but by Monday, you should be able to see what I've been working on. I can say it's a laptop, I think, and I love it. I really like it. And then I'm also working on a unique app in VR that should help during this whole like stuck at home time. I'm just happy that we have so many phones to distract us. We have so many gadgets to distract us these days. I don't know. It feels nice.
Yeah. If you can spend some time with work, it really helps you ignore the world being on fire. For sure.
Absolutely.
Anyway, are you working on anything, V, you want to talk about?
I'm working on a lot of things and I can talk about none of these things.
Okay.
You're working on staying healthy and staying sane too, I hope.
All right, and as for our picks, fun stuff this week, I am spending a lot of time with the Final Fantasy VII Remake, a thing which I can't believe exists. We've been pining. First of all, I've been dreaming about this for like at least the past two decades, like ever since the PlayStation 2, like really, we got more powerful consoles. I've been dreaming of like what it would be like to revisit that world with more powerful machines. Think about 5 years ago, they announced that this remake was actually happening, and it is fantastic. It is a reimagining of Final Fantasy VII, or at least like the first act of it, in a really good looking modern game with like a battle system that is like hybrid action game slash like really tactical RPG at times too. It's so good. It's beautiful. The music's fantastic. Like, it's a great, like, I don't know. I can't believe this game exists. It's kind of a miracle in a way. Like, it exists and it's good and it's going to be like 40 hours long. So I'm about 10 hours in right now. I'm really digging it. We want to talk with Matt Smith from Engadget UK, who reviewed it for us and has already beaten it. But he is out sick. So unfortunately,
but you can still watch his review video.
You can watch his video. YouTube. Listen to his dulcet British tones. Review Final Fantasy VII Remake.
Describing, FF7's like plot and how it's different from the original. And you see a lot of good graphics from the game.
So it's very pretty. So what have you been up to, Sherlyn?
I mean, I'm still trying to like secure my spot as the Asian film recommender on this show.
I mean, you should be. I am.
So I've been watching a lot of...
I know, because you've watched all these damn movies, yeah.
I've been watching a lot of others, like, you know, fair credit to Dev, he recommended, I watched Train to Busan a while ago, and I finally did. It's really good. I watched The Host, which is Bong Joon-ho's, one of his earlier works. It's also really good.
Host is so good. First of all, if you have seen Parasite and you like Parasite, track down The Host.
Yeah, The Host is on Hulu. That's where I saw it.
Such a smart monster movie, yeah. And it will break your heart.
Parasite's also on Hulu. Yeah, yeah, it will break your heart for sure. It's very sweet. But that's not what I want to talk about, because those are like things I had to credit Devendra about, so no. But I am, however, pretty confident in my Asian horror film taste and my Asian horror film knowledge, and I've watched a lot of those growing up. Mm-hmm. I'm going to dig deep into the archives and recommend a Filipino horror movie called Feng Shui, F-E-N-G-S-H-U-I, Feng Shui. You're going to be a little confused. Because Feng Shui is technically a very Chinese, believe mm-hmm. in Chinese culture, but that's because Asia shares a lot of cultures anyway. And it's just this really, it was so scary. I remember I was watching it in my teens. It's very hard to find nowadays, but I think it's on both.
Is it a horror movie about bad furniture placement?
No.
Like what?
A little bit.
What happened?
No, it's about this, we call it the Bagua. It's a it's a Taoist, it's kind of like a supernatural mirror thing that people hang up on their homes or on door frames and stuff like that. And in this particular show, when you like see your reflection in this Bagua, like hanging there in front of this house, you're next to die or something like that. But the way you die is very interesting because it all boils down to Asian mysticism, and it's about your zodiac, the Chinese zodiac. So like if you're born in the year of chicken, you're killed by a bunch of chickens.
Wait, this is a Filipino movie?
Yeah. It is a Filipino
movie.
This
sounds amazing.
It's really good. It sounds really great.
It is very much I saw this movie was released in 2004, so it's very post-Ringu. And I feel like, Ringu is the one, like, Hideo Nakata's Ringu changed the face of horror forever.
Yes.
I actually, as much as I love the original, I think the remake is better, and we can have a good argument about that.
The remake of The Ring? Really?
The Ring, yeah. Gore Verbinski's
The American
Ring,
one.
I think, is one of the best horror movies of the last, like, two
decades.
Wait,
the one that America made.
The one America made. Like, every country made their own Ring version.
Right.
Right now, Sherlyn is making a ring face at me, so I'm very terrified. Oh, God. Like, her mouth is agape. The Ring is great. Korea has one, too.
Yeah.
It feels like, in Japan, they made several, remakes of that one movie. But anyway, a lot of great horror movies out there.
So many. I'm going to start you off with Feng Shui. It's a very obscure one. It might be hard to find, but again, you'll be able to find it. There's also The Grudge, if you haven't seen it. It's really, really good. The original Grudge is very good.
Not the,
Grudge.
Like, we made a second remake of The
good.
Grudge
it's,
in America. I don't know why, but okay. No.
Yeah, it's not good at all. But I'll keep giving you guys more Asian horror films. So I love horror and I love Asian horror films. And they're so much scarier to me because I grew up in that culture and believing in all of those superstitions.
Yeah. Right now, the only Asian horror films I'm watching are You Two Without Fire Extinguishers. So please.
Cool. All right. Feel great about myself now, Dev. I love it. So to bring myself out of this funk that I've now deservedly been thrust into... I lean on YouTube a lot for just sort of finding little moments of joy. And one channel in particular lately has been really doing it for me. It's called Mr. Go Lightly. This person seems to specialize in putting together supercuts of different actors and actresses singing like the same climactic moments in shows, in Broadway shows. So I will go through and like watch 15 minutes of everyone singing the end of Defying Gravity. And like the comment section is just like, oh, she killed it, but she was like a little pitchy. And this person could have been a little better. Give it like two or three more years. She'll get there. You'll be great.
This seems like something for Sherlyn, by the way. Like, I think our judgiest karaoke attendee. So perfect.
It pains me so much to say this, but Sherlyn is the best at karaoke.
Yeah, I don't want to go to karaoke with Sherlyn anymore. It's not
That's
good.
That's not true. If y'all want to see me and V kill it at Defying Gravity, I have it up on my Instagram stories. It's one of my highlights. I know. Yeah, I have the
Good
video
God.
Of when we did carpool karaoke to Defying Gravity.
Jesus.
It's great. Check it out. But that sounds... So Mr. Go Lightly YouTube channel. Is that it?
Yeah. Find some joy there. If you love musicals, if you love theater, if you love Broadway, you'll fall down this rabbit hole for sure.
Well, that's it for us this week. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Sherlyn online. Where?
I'm at Sherlyn Low on Twitter. Send me your fire extinguisher tips.
Please. And Chris Velasco, where can we find you?
I'm at Chris Velasco on Twitter or hit me up on email, v@engadget.com.
Oh, man, that's you're very brave to do that. You can find me on Twitter at @Devendra. I podcast about movies and TV at @filmcast at /film.com. We just reviewed Tiger King, which is not good.
You liked it 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. And we're also doing Memories of Murder, so talking about like great Bong Joon-ho movies. So catch up on that. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify. Okay, now that Sherlyn and Chris are gone, we can get to this interview with Nathaniel Halpern, the creator of Tales from the Loop. And this is a show I've been looking forward to for a while. I've been a huge fan of Simon Stollenhag's artwork. You've probably seen it shared around the internet. It's usually a peaceful Norwegian countryside scene with like a robot or something very science fiction-y in it. And his artwork really conveys this interesting idea of normalcy meets science fiction in a fascinating way. And I think the show does a great job of exploring that whole thing. So here's my chat with Nathaniel Halpern. Hi, Nathaniel.
Hi, very nice to meet you over the phone.
Gotcha. Well, I'm just going to jump right into questions just to conserve your time here. I'm wondering what led you to want to adapt Tales from the Loop. Were you inspired by the art that was floating around the internet from Simon Stollenhag? Like, was that the main thing for you?
Well, yeah, actually, I was introduced to Simon's work through the director Matt Reeves and his producing partners.
Okay.
And I was just really taken by the aesthetic that he created, that marriage between the ordinary and extraordinary, and also the emotion that's in his work. And then just the idea of how do you adapt paintings into a TV series? That just seemed like a wonderfully unique challenge, and mm-hmm. I wasn't about to pass that up.
Gotcha. And I know you're coming off of Legion, too, which was kind of a really interesting task as a TV show, too. Like, how did your experience on that show translate to, you know, working on adapting paintings at this point?
Yeah, I mean, Legion was another unique experience and a unique show, quite different from Tales from the Loop. Mm-hmm. I think, if anything, just learning how to adapt from one visual medium to another sort of informed it. But Tales from the Loop was just so different from Legion. And here there was really no roadmap. Mm-hmm. So it was essentially just using these visuals as visual prompts to tell stories.
Gotcha. And yeah, can you talk more about that process too? Because I've seen all three of the screeners that you guys sent out. And what I'm fascinated by is how you've kind of captured the sparseness of both the artwork, but also like that little hint of emotion, of nostalgia, of like, I don't know, memory of a lost civilization or something too. You've kind of wrapped that into all the stories as well. What was that process like?
Well, yeah, you use that word nostalgia, and mm-hmm. I have an interesting relationship with that word in that for me, I wasn't terribly interested in nostalgia for media, meaning pop culture.
Right.
And just reminding you of other things you've seen. And here I wanted to reference our own life experiences, things you've experienced as a child or other chapters in your life. So a lot of times, as you said, there's this emotion in Simon's work mm-hmm. and there's this universal quality to it. And I wanted to tap into these feelings we've all felt. And so when my hope is really if someone could watch it and think, oh, I recognize that. That reminds me of myself. And that there's an element of empathy within the show. And that's kind of my approach to nostalgia in that regard.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's really interesting to me how you've really focused on the human aspects of the storytelling. Were you at all inspired by like any of the background narratives that Simon was building up for Tales from the Loop?
Not so much. For instance, I had no exposure to the role-playing game.
Right.
And it was really, I took Simon's core premise, which was the loop is the facility that exists beneath this town. And experiments are done, and the byproducts litter the landscape above. Mm-hmm. And that's where I hung my hat on that premise. But otherwise, Simon was just very supportive of having me take it and run, because we saw eye to eye very early on that, yes, this is more about the people than the science fiction.
Right.
Very often, you know, I'm a big fan of the genre. Very often, though, the characters are there to service the idea that's at play. And here I wanted the science fiction idea to actually amplify the experience that the character is having. So mm-hmm. I kind of flip the formula that you see very often.
Yeah, I think that's partially perhaps why the show is working so well for me, too, is that you're not even really leaning on the science fiction aspects. It shows up once in a while, but sort of like his paintings, right? It is a thing in the background that is very interesting, but we're more focused on the humans most of the time.
Yeah, and I think there's a fascinating reality that develops out of that, mm-hmm. in that so often a science fiction element is treated like a shiny toy.
Right.
And here, treating it as rather ordinary, which Simon does in his paintings, makes it feel realer, because the characters are never really asking how this is happening. They know it ties back to the loop somehow, so mm-hmm. we don't have to waste that time in the story of people asking each other, how could this be happening, which isn't terribly compelling. Here, it's just, well, what does it mean for them, and how does it change them? So there is this fascinating aesthetic that started with those paintings of treating the science fiction as rather ordinary.
Right, right. One thing that was really interesting, too, is that this seems like a rare TV show where characters have there's a lot of time where characters can spend on the emotions, and the show isn't like rushing past, you know, some big dramatic moments. Was that like the tempo of the storytelling? Was that something you also kind of adapted from the art, or was that just like the way you want to tell this? I see so many shows, especially sci-fi shows. I'm thinking of like the Amazing Stories thing that just hit Apple TV Plus. It's so they rush through so many things, you never have time to absorb the story.
Yeah, that's unfortunate with a lot of programming these days. I would say that it stems from my own sense of storytelling that I think emotion is given a lot of lip service, but the dirty little secret is you need to take the time to have the emotion felt.
Yeah.
And not just have characters and us as an audience pulled through a very dense plot. So I strove to tell stories. There's an elegance to Simon's work. I strove to tell stories that would have the simplicity of a fable.
Yeah.
And that could be followed very easily, which then allows you to invest in the character versus doing the math of the plot turns. And that hopefully what is most compelling is you hope these characters end up okay. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're leaning in for, that you have empathy for them and you're feeling what they're feeling, their loves and disappointments throughout the story. Because I find very often, rarely do I recount, there was that great plot.
Right.
About it. It's usually these little human moments that sear themselves into my mind when I think back to things that have really affected me over the years. And so creating a show that could really harness those little moments.
Gotcha. And what was it like bringing Simon's work to life? It seems like the production design of a show like this seems very delicate. How much of it is practical? How much of it is CG? And how did you go about like just realizing this world?
Well, it was a wonderful gift having Simon's paintings. Mm-hmm. I think personally that the hardest part is creating a world and a tone and an aesthetic that is compelling enough that would make you want to watch it. And so we had that in spades with Simon's work. And then wherever possible, I tried to just be very faithful to that's what that looks like. Let's mm-hmm. build that. So there was many instances where we actually built the structure. And then when Simon came to visit the set, it was quite something to see him see these things in real life that he had dreamed up. And similarly, he has such a strong aesthetic that I asked him several times for things that I invented within the stories. I said, well, what would this look like within the world of Tales from the Loop? And he very generously designed those elements. And then my visual effects team built them. Mm-hmm. So to answer the other part of the question is we could do something practical. We did it. The robot was built. But then there would be a seamless transition to when it's, you know, walking,
right,
it would be a CG asset. So I think there is this wonderful marriage within the show between these practical elements and the very well done CG enhancements.
Mm-hmm. I definitely got a sense of like the original Star Wars trilogy, which I think a lot of people like because the tech is like very practical and dirty too, and it feels very lived in. That robot, you're talking about the bipedal robot that is kind of in the background watching people, right? Was that the largest thing you guys actually built?
It wasn't the largest thing we built, but it was certainly, I think, what made the most crowds come and look at it.
Right, right.
Legacy Effect did this wonderful, wonderful job of building that. And it had so much life to it and personality, which was invaluable in performance, acting against it. But the Ecosphere, we built that. When you go beneath ground to the Loop facility, that's all built, including that central object, the Eclipse. We built about 3/4 of that, and it has some slight enhancement with CG. So it really felt like a reality we were stepping into versus green screen.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And what sort of things was Simon, did you tap Simon for to help design? Was it like that, the Eclipse at the in the basement and other things?
No, the Eclipse there, that was a nice collaboration between me, the director, Mark Romanek, and the production designer of the pilot, Phil Messina, arriving at that, which was wanting something that felt both futuristic and ancient and organic. And that's how we arrived at that design. But, I'd asked Simon, for instance, the character who has a bionic arm. Mm-hmm. I asked him, well, what would a bionic arm look like in this world? And in no time at all, he turned it around and had this beautiful design, which was the arm. And then we had both a practical arm and a CG asset of the arm, depending on the needs of the scene. And so my visual effects team built that arm that Simon designed. And then there's another a device in episode 3 that I knew roughly the shape and that it needed a switch. And outside of that, I said, Simon, what would this look like? And once again, he turned out a great, very tactile, earthy design. And it's like, okay, let's just go build that. So he was wonderful to work with.
Oh, that's great. That's great to hear. Like, I could definitely feel like, the soul of his artwork kind of running through this show. And when it comes to also bringing it to life, the pilot directed by Mark Romanek, I think was very effective and very like evocative of things he's done in the past. I loved his Never Let Me Go adaptation. Did he help you kind of shape the style of the entire series?
Well, it was wonderful when when Mark and I first met, there's just this wonderful Venn diagram of our sensibilities crossing over. So it was just such a wonderful collaboration and bringing in all of our film references and photography references and painting references. And he was just invaluable in bringing this to life. And the filmmakers that we would often talk about would be Ingmar Bergman, Krzysztof Kieslowski, right. Andrei Tarkovsky. And we would make these references. And I just learned so much from him. And he did bring a brilliant visual reality to the world.
Oh, that's great. I'm really looking forward to seeing more from him in general. He's a fantastic filmmaker. Is there anything else you wanted to add, Nathaniel, about adapting Tales from the Loop? And would you want to do a second season of this? Because I feel like there are so many stories to tell here.
Yeah, I would love to do a second season. What's wonderful is the structure of the show and the nature of the loop. It's a storytelling generating device.
Right, right.
So the possibilities are somewhat endless in that regard. And I would just say in general, I'm a big fan of the genre. And what I love about this opportunity was to tell science fiction stories that were perhaps tonally different than what you see out there, that it's right. not a show that preys on anxiety and fear and anger, that there's actually a great deal of empathy and emotion in these stories. And hopefully the audience can take a bit of comfort from it and that there's a hard-earned sense of hope to these stories that without becoming sentimental.
Gotcha. Yeah. I feel like I've left every episode with my heart in my throat a little bit. So mission accomplished.
Oh, well, thank you very much. That's nice of you to say.
No problem. Well, thank you so much for the chat and good luck with the launch of the series and everything.
All right. Thank you so much.